United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe.
The producers would like to note that this episode was recorded on July 7th, 2017, a month before the tragic events in Charlottesville, Virginia, surrounding the Robert E. Lee statue and related protests and counter-protests. United Lutheran Seminary expresses deepest sympathy for those killed and injured in Charlottesville. We also encourage our listeners to revisit the episode titled Not Waiting for the Hero, to hear an example of a unique form of nonviolent counter-protest that was carried out 10 years ago under similar circumstances.
The last weekend in Gettysburg, we had a gathering of armed persons forming a kind of informal militia, which flooded the national park, the battlefield, in response to social media, which said that certain persons were coming to tear down flags and deface monuments. Nothing came of that because there was no group that showed up to do these things. But in the meantime, it shows that we have a serious issue in American society, one on the very cusp of violence that relates to taking down monuments, defacing them, or taking down flags and defacing them. It's time we get some perspective on this very fraught issue. Our guest will help us with that today. She is Jill Titus, the Associate Director of the Civil War Institute at Gettysburg College, and the author of Brown's Battleground. It refers to the famous Supreme Court decision of Brown versus Board of Education concerning equal opportunity in education, and she studied a southern county, Prince Edward County in Virginia. Outside of what happened this weekend, what's the context of all this, do you think? What's your feeling, your take, the background, the context of this very difficult issue?
Well, I think that people have been struggling over the meaning and nature of Civil War monuments for a very, very long time. I think that many Americans haven't been aware of this conversation until the summer of 2015, the shooting in Charleston, the realization of the extent to which that white supremacist violence was connected with lost cause ideology and pro-Confederate groups. I think that incident caused many Americans to start looking at monuments and symbols of the Confederacy in a way that they hadn't been looking at them earlier. Scholars have been having this conversation for a long time, just struggling to understand the meaning of the flag, the way that meaning has shifted and evolved over the last 150 years, and the way that interpretations of the Civil War and ideas about race were inscribed into our monument landscape. These things have always been there. It's not that they suddenly appeared. It's that people are now seeing them and interpreting them and questioning them in a way that they haven't done before.
So there's a matter of brass or concrete or whatever the statue, the monument, or cloth as the flag are made out of, and then the important thing you're stressing is the interpretation. And once they rise to the point of becoming a symbol, especially a loaded symbol, mm-hmm. American flags, Christian flags, mm-hmm. Christian crosses, mm-hmm. The Jewish Star of David, and so on,
sure.
There's something suddenly more than cloth or brass or mm-hmm. concrete.
Mm-hmm.
Interpretation is the key.
Right.
When you talk about interpretation, then, Would you emphasize context of whether or not certain monuments are removed or not removed?
I would. I think that there's definitely no one-size-fits-all approach for this. I think that the best possible outcome that could come out of this increasing concern and debate and the intensity of this debate is that individual communities begin to question and have dialogue surrounding the monuments in their midst, begin to look into the history of why these monuments came to be, who advocated for them, what was the process through which they were placed there, what was the context of what was happening both broadly across the country and in that individual community at the time that they were placed. I think that's the first step, understanding, contextualizing, being able to see that the placement of this monument, particularly the placement in whatever specific location it's in, is more than just an expression of a desire to commemorate history. People don't just put up monuments because they want to commemorate a historical event. It's always shaped by the way that they are interpreting that historical event in the present or drawing on the meaning of that event to give support and life and legitimacy to whatever causes they themselves are espousing in the present. So I think that understanding context is vitally important. But I think that communities can reach different conclusions mm-hmm. about what to do once they have a better understanding of that context. I think that some communities might choose to reinterpret a monument, to put up some sort of wayside explaining how it came to be there, what groups supported it, what it had to do with contemporary politics of that day. I think other communities might choose to do a little bit more than that. They might they might add another monument, interpreting a different story and putting those two in tension. Some mm-hmm. communities might decide that these monuments don't have a place in our community anymore. They might decide to take them down, to put them in a museum where they can be interpreted. They might reach a yeah. variety of different conclusions about what's an appropriate thing to do. And I think that what sort of a space a monument is in would certainly play into that. Is a monument in a cemetery? Is it on a battlefield? Is it on another piece of historic ground? Is it mm-hmm. in a civic space like a courthouse or in front of a school? All of that shapes the meaning mm-hmm. of that monument. It shapes its context, and I think it shapes how a community or how the stewards of this place might decide that they need to move forward with it.
I've got to say, that's the trouble with us academics, right? There are no yes or no. There's context.
Yes.
Let's take a look at that case and this case. And you know what? But that's exactly why we are here for an interview. I'm going to give you three cases, though, before we go on to the bigger interpretive mm-hmm. issues, which you have raised, especially the politics about 1890 when some of these monuments mm-hmm. were raised, about the Civil War centennial in Gettysburg, which is a good example, mm-hmm. and about the so-called mm-hmm. lost cause of the Confederacy, about which people may not have heard so much, but is very important for this interpretation. But before I do that, let's do a checklist. As briefly as you can, would you have removed the monuments in New Orleans? What about the famous Monument Avenue in Richmond? And what about the monuments at Gettysburg National Battlefield?
Wow.
That's the rest of the hour, but
well.
See if you can be brief. I mean, you're trying to be subtle. You're trying
yes.
to say context.
Right.
Have you drawn any conclusions about those three places?
Well,
there could be in between. Could
sure,
be yes, no, in between.
Sure. I mean, I don't think I'm qualified to say what I would do or what I should do because I'm not a resident of Richmond. I'm not a resident of New Orleans. I can talk about Gettysburg because
right.
I am a resident of Gettysburg,
right.
and I am a historian, and so I am delighted to have the opportunity to use this historic landscape around us as a teaching tool. I'm out on the battlefield with my students frequently. I think that the power of place is an incredibly important teaching tool. It's an incredibly important thing for connecting people to the past. The battlefield of Gettysburg helps people connect in a very site-specific and emotional way to a history that comes across very differently when you're reading about it in a book, when you're standing in the space and you are looking at the landscape that people saw. You're able to understand their experiences and their emotions in a whole new way. Because this battlefield is not just a landscape devoted to the history of 1863, but a commemorative landscape that reflects how generations since have interpreted the meaning of the Battle of Gettysburg, I think the monuments that were erected here in the 1960s are an incredible opportunity to encourage conversation about the connections between historical memory and contemporary politics. In the 1960s, many of the new Confederate monuments that went up on the battlefield, like the monument to the South Carolina troops, the monument to the Florida troops, both of which are along West Confederate Avenue, those came out of a context that 1963, when we think about 1963, yes. we think about Birmingham, yes. we think about civil rights protests, we think about sit-ins, we yes. think about George Wallace yes. standing in the schoolhouse door.
Yes.
We think about the Cold War. We know, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis
yes.
had just taken place. And when people came to Gettysburg in the summer of 1963 to commemorate the battle, they were making clear and obvious connections to the present. They brought different interpretations mm-hmm. of Gettysburg mm-hmm. to this commemoration, and they used those interpretations to draw different conclusions mm-hmm. about what the country ought to be doing in the present. Mm-hmm. Out at the South Carolina Monument, George Wallace was the dedication speaker at that monument, and he stood up there and he talked about the sanctity of states' rights mm-hmm. and the South struggling against mm-hmm. federal tyranny. And it was very clear that he was talking more about the present mm-hmm. than he was mm-hmm. about yep. the past. Yep. He made explicit links between the Confederate cause and the contemporary fight against desegregation.
That's right. mm-hmm.
yep. Out at the Florida Monument, people made a very different argument. They talked about the Cold War. They talked about international politics. They talked about the way that America's image was being damaged by racial violence in the mm-hmm. United States. And they said, if we want to make the sacrifice of our soldiers at Gettysburg worth anything, then we have to change our actions. We can't have police dogs attacking protesters. We need to move the battle into the courts, so there's an attempt to put some limits on yeah. protest. But at the same time, there was an open acknowledgement that if America is just a country for the white man, then the Civil War has no meaning, and the sacrifice of our soldiers, Confederate soldiers, has no meaning. Mm. And when we think about Florida politics in 1963, they had just come out of the Cuban Missile Crisis. This was a state where tourism was becoming increasingly important, a state where open clashes were being discouraged, a state where more and more Northerners were moving in, where regional identity was sort of becoming subsumed in this larger national identity. It's these monuments tell us so much about meaning. Out at the Peace Light, which of course has been here much longer than the 1960s, but there was a ceremony during the 1963 anniversary out there where one of the members of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights gave a sermon calling on Americans to make good on the promises of the Civil War by embracing emancipation in all forms, by ending discrimination in voting and in education and employment and housing. These are three very different interpretations of the meaning of the Civil War in the present, and I think these monuments are amazing. They're amazing ways into that.
Jill Titus is our guest. She's the Associate Director of the Civil War Institute at Gettysburg College and the author of Brown's Battleground, a history in Prince Edward County, Virginia, of the conflict created and the changes created by Brown versus Board of Education, the great Supreme Court decision about equality in education in America. And I'm Jerry Christensen. You're listening to the Seminary Explorers, broadcasting today from Gettysburg, where we have a very strong feeling about these subjects, which is now, and this may be our first broadcast where we can say, which is now the United Lutheran Seminary of the East, Gettysburg campus. Jill, you've raised most of the issues I wanted to ask you about, but let me simply start making sure we're clear, because people want to know. There are some places then that you might support the removal of certain kinds of symbols.
Yes.
Flags, the flag on top of a state,
yes.
a state capital,
yes.
a Confederate flag,
yes.
above the American flag, perhaps mm-hmm. would be an
at
example.
At all.
Maybe a monument in the front of a church or a mm-hmm. school or something mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. would be appropriate, but not all of them. Not Lee on General Lee on Traveler here in Gettysburg, or the Great Lee Monument in Richmond, or necessarily.
Again,
without
I think
discussion.
Right. I think context is incredibly important, and I think that I think if you're going to talk about a monument that is on, you know, is on taxpayer land, then it's important to recognize that the people who are paying taxes to support the place, to support the upkeep of that monument, are the ones that really ultimately have the right to make these decisions. But yes, I applauded when the city of New Orleans began to take down some of its monuments, particularly the one to the Battle of Liberty Place, which is a monument that has glorified an expression of enormous violence. That monument wasn't even about the Civil War itself. It glorified a white supremacist attack on the integrated city government of New Orleans during Reconstruction. I think that what is often very difficult for people who come at monuments more from a theoretical sense, thinking about the significance of the history or the interpretation or the hard work that those who erected the monument put into it, what they often miss is the fact that other members of their community see and interpret that monument very differently than they do. For many African Americans, these monuments are not, they're not dispassionate interpretations of history that they might disagree with, but
your finger in the eye.
Exactly. They are extraordinarily painful symbols that to many suggest a continued place of subservience in American culture.
The larger interpretation you've suggested before, I'd like to have you spin that out of it, not spill it out, but spin that out a bit more. And I think of two things that we might not have heard a great deal about. Number one, the Civil War Centennial in Gettysburg, for example, was more than just a remembrance. As a teaching opportunity, we can see how people understood the battle in 1913. Which was a time, in fact, we're on a campus where they built a peace portico afterwards.
Sure,
the money that they received from the federal government because they hosted the Confederates and former Confederate veterans and Union veterans. The need there was to try to reunite or to unify or strengthen the sense of unity in America.
Right.
You would not disagree with that.
No, not at all.
So that was
same story with the Peace Light here in Gettysburg, the 75th anniversary of the battle.
Exactly. Oh yes, and dedicated by a president even, you know, we were still searching for ways of saying we are one nation. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You know, and we may have lost that sense after all these years. Now we got other issues. But then explain to us a little bit more about what is sometimes called the lost cause, which was more prevalent between, say, 1890 and 1913, somewhere in there.
Sure. I mean, the lost cause is essentially a reinterpretation of the Civil War that disassociates the Confederate cause from slavery and emancipation. It makes slavery incidental to the war and stresses the idea that Southern states seceded from the Union over issues of tariffs or economics and went to war solely to defend their homeland. The lost cause is an interpretation of the war that paints the Confederacy as almost without flaws and suggests that the only reason that the South lost the war was because the North had superior technology, it had more soldiers, it could simply wear down the South. This interpretation didn't begin to develop until the years after the war. The secession declarations are very clear that these states are seceding over slavery and that states' rights is about the right to continue to maintain a slave system. The lost cause also tended to either ignore African Americans or suggest that African Americans were loyal subjects of the Confederacy, that they embraced this cause, that they even fought with their owners on the battlefield and fought to defend plantations when Union troops came through, instead of stressing the huge numbers of African Americans who enlisted in the Union Army, who served as scouts and spies and laundresses, those who emancipated themselves by fleeing from their homes. You know, part of the And one of the monument traditions of the Lost Cause tended to emphasize the cause more than those who were lost. The very first generation of Confederate monuments were monuments about grief. They were monuments in cemeteries. Yeah, yeah. They were monuments to the fallen, to those who had
and that
died.
Was a common cause. They found common cause in that, didn't they?
Yes.
They could find unification in that we suffered as well as you suffered. You know, so there was a north-south connection there.
I mean, I think any society that has experienced an enormous war like that, you see this kind of monumentation coming out, a way of memorializing loss and memorializing those who died. It's the second generation of monuments, the more lost cause-oriented monuments, that tend to glorify the cause. These are the monuments that were most common today, the ones that we think of, the generals standing on horseback, much larger than life, the monuments that suggest that white Southerners were entirely unified in this cause, which is not true at all. And it is, in fact, part of the reason that the South lost the war. And there's a famous quote that that something along the lines of that Kentucky didn't become Confederate until after the war. These monuments suggest a narrative of white unity that simply didn't exist. And part of the other monument, the dimension of the Lost Cause that sometimes gets less attention, are there were even monuments erected to faithful slaves during these years, monuments that embraced this interpretation that African Americans had loyally supported the Confederacy and that they should be honored for their subordination and their submission and their loyalty. This is a whole different world than the idea that African Americans were freedom fighters, were supporting the Union cause, were soldiers. So I think that one of the most famous monuments coming out of this Lost not just one monument, but one of the most famous monument landscapes coming out of this Lost Cause era is Monument Avenue in Richmond, which is sort of a whole panoply of Confederate leaders, and in recent years has also become home to a statue of Arthur Ashe, the black tennis great from Richmond as well. But the most famous monument on Monument Avenue is the Monument to Lee, which was erected in 1890, and I think when we look at that monument, we see this towering statue of Lee. We see the idea of Lee as the great leader of the Confederacy. What we don't see are the politics in Virginia that gave rise to that monument. We don't see the African Americans in the crowd who looked up at that and said, the white man's back on top. We don't see that very same year, Virginia's first black congressman was defeated in an election where white Democrats ran on the platform of party doesn't matter. This is about we have to restore the white man's government in Virginia. And if I could say one other thing, we don't see John Mitchell, the publisher of the Richmond Planet, a black paper in the city, standing there in that crowd and writing later in his newspaper, the black man put this monument up. Black laborers certainly did erect that monument and will be there in the future to take it down when the time comes. And to me, it's that idea. These monuments are not history. They are interpretations of history, and interpretations of history change, and that's a good thing. That is the whole premise of how scholars approach the study of the past, that our interpretations change as new sources become available, as our current day context causes us to ask new questions and to reach new conclusions about the meaning and nature of the past. We don't expect that books will stand, that the books will last forever, that an interpretation laid out in a book will be that interpretation forever. But I think we tend to think that interpretations on the landscape, that monuments, are forever. I don't think they should be. Of course, there are some serious questions about cost associated with this. It's not like we can be constantly ripping things down and putting up new $200,000 interpretations of the past. But I think that, for me, so much of this comes down to a fundamental misunderstanding about what monuments are. I think they are not history. They are interpretations of history.
And as such, we don't need to go out and tear them down immediately or even to defend them with our guns immediately. It's more important to understand context and is the opportunity for conversation. There's no easy answers, but enter the conversation rather than and the context rather than simply have a quick, a simple reaction. Jill Titus is our guest. She is the Associate Director of the Civil War Institute at Gettysburg College. I'm Jerry Christensen for the Seminary Explorers. Have a very good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explorers, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. All opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.